In recent years, there has been an increased discussion of mental illness and mental health. Also, there have been cases which have shown that mental health issues may be particularly affecting public safety workers. Rose Ricciardelli is an associate professor at Memorial, and she's studied the mental health rates of correctional facility workers and other public safety workers such as first responders. In addition, she has studied the effects of prison time on people who have been incarcerated. I'm John Sanlos, director of the Nexus Center, and in this episode of Cross Currents, I talked with Rose Ricciardelli about her work. All right, we're here this morning with Rose Ricciardelli. She is an associate professor of sociology here at Memorial University, and we're very happy to have you at the Nexus Center.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, you've written a number of books on a wide range of subjects related to themes such as crime, discipline, and punishment. And before we get into your latest project, I thought maybe you could give us an overview of some of your main books. So let's start first with the book you wrote in 2014 about Canada's prisons, and it's called Surviving Incarceration, Inside Canada's Prisons. Let us know a little bit about that book.
So the impetus for that book was actually getting to know federal releasees, so individuals who'd been released either on their stat or on parole. So in Canada, a federal sentence is anyone serving more than 2 years in prison, and less would be provincial. So, and generally how it works is everyone becomes eligible to be released on at least a parole or full parole after serving one third of a sentence. If they don't make parole, so they don't get out after a third, they can get out at two thirds. And that's sort of like a statutory requirement, so your statutory release. So in speaking to individuals, and generally the people who make up that book were considered higher risk prisoners or offenders, and they were released into Toronto, and they had more than the normative supervision. So they had a very, in some ways unique, but in other ways a very common experience of incarceration. So what I really wanted to do when I was looking and trying to learn about the Canadian prison experience, I found that there was really a lack in knowledge of what happens in our federal prisons in Canada currently. We don't really have a lot of scholars who actually have access to the prisons and are doing the work within the prisons. So I thought it was really important to try to contextualize what incarceration looks like now. And one of the key things that really came out of it is classic works and classic understanding of incarceration is that prisoners have sort of a collective mentality, and that everyone is kind of working together for the betterment. So even something like the inmate code was all about collective solidarity and being a group, sort of. And what I really found, it was very individualistic now, no different than what we see in society, where prisoners were, although the presentation was of a collective front, people were very self-focused in their activities and were doing things to better their own position. So a lot of the normal tenets of incarceration were no longer evident among people nowadays. And I think that's a really important contribution to knowledge and to literature, especially when we look at reentry planning and rehabilitative programming.
Wow, and you continued in a way on that theme with your most recent book. You co-authored, it just came out this year, a book with Dale Spencer, a study of how sex offenders get treated in the criminal justice system, and that's called Violence, Sex Offenders, and Justice, and it's now out with Routledge. Can you tell me a little bit about that project and how you got interested in that topic and where you took it through your research?
And so the most recent book, actually, Dale Spencer and I, we took a different approach in this book, and we took a pretty risky position in many ways, but one that we both strongly believed in, because we really wanted to shed more light on what constitutes what we call in society a sex offender, and to try to get some more insight into what exactly is going on, not just in the treatment. It's pretty common knowledge that sex offenders are treated very poorly by fellow prisoners, by society, and by those who are working in the correctional institutions at times. So what we wanted to do is really look at what constitutes a sex offender and how do we understand them. So when we use the word offender, which is not a common word anymore used in criminological literature, because the idea of an offender would suggest that a person is in a constant state of offending, which begs the question, at what point is someone no longer the individual who committed that crime? So, but in the same way, a sex offender, you don't want to reduce the offense caused by their actions, because it also does very little to the victim if you try to do that. So how we constitute a sex offender is an individual who's accused, convicted, or charged with criminal behaviors that violate the sexual norms in our society. So they're actually offending our morals in society. And that's how we start that understanding. And then we really try to unpack the diversities and who is viewed or labeled as a sex offender and what that means, and then how that impacts those experiences of incarceration and life more generally. So we take a different kind of perspective, and we really try to shed light on how that label in itself might not really resonate well with the criminal behavior that caused the label. So for example, you may have an individual who, you know, there's a very small gap between, or you know, youth, for example, where even the possession of any sort of nude photograph of a youth by a youth is considered possessing child pornography. So, and then if you were to show that to a friend, you're now distributing child pornography. So that sex offender label can get very quickly tied to a youth just because of what has become normal, relatively normal processes in our society and in this digital image sharing. So we try to show the diversity in that label and how it's not a one size fits all label, and then try to understand how that label in itself really impacts a person's experiences. And that was really the context of the book, is really trying to show, you know, the emotionality tied to it, both by the people applying the label and the people labeled, the moral understandings, the norms around it, and then how that impacts experiences of incarceration and of even working in a prison setting. Mm-hmm. So, and that was kind of the context of the book.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it sounds like a really fascinating and worthwhile read.
It's a different take on sex offenders.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you seem to have almost flipped on its end your focus of your research, because you've looked at offenders a lot in the criminal justice system, and you kind of turned that around and you've expanded your scope, and you're looking at people almost on the other side, those who serve the public, not only law enforcement agents, but people who respond to emergencies and so on. I guess what we could call broadly public safety personnel or public safety workers, you know, paramedics, ambulance operators, firefighters. And you're looking at issues around post-traumatic stress. Tell us how you got on this path.
So actually, one of the forthcoming books I have is about correctional officers working in the correctional systems. And basically what started this whole movement towards correctional officer-based research and public safety personnel was a Thanksgiving in a halfway house where we were just sitting around. Thanksgiving, I used to go when I was in Ontario, and we'd go, you know, go for Thanksgiving dinner and spend some time with a lot of the people who I spent a lot of time with interviewing or at different day reporting centers. So what had happened is when we were just sitting around relaxing, talking, we started speaking a little bit about the incarceration experience. And a lot of people put forth that the hardest time that anyone does is actually in remand prior to being federally sentenced. So within that context, you're not sure how long you're going away for, if you're staying more localized to where your family is, or if you're going to be transported to a federal institution, and you don't really know what it means. You're about to lose everything. This is the whole purpose of incarceration. You're removed from your life. So if you're going away for 20 years, these things that we don't always think about is what happens to your home, your belongings, your possessions, your, you know, all the loss associated with it. What, especially, and you're not in a position where you can actually make decisions about what's going to happen to your things, your family, or etc., because you're behind bars with very limited contact. So a lot of individuals spoke about how the hardest time they ever did was in remand prior to that federal sentence. And they remembered very clearly that that's where they were treated the best and the worst by the correctional staff. And what they found is that there were times, and many will talk about, you know, the room in a particular institution where their family came with their kids and there's no contact. And, you know, they came and their wife or partner said, "This is the last time you're going to see your kids. Like, good luck to you. It's over." And they remember walking out of that and being in complete disarray. And it was the correctional officer who, instead of bringing them back to their unit where they would appear very vulnerable, which is not a good thing in a prison setting, they gave them a minute. They would say, okay, they stop at a hall, let the person get together, calm down a bit. And then without overly engaging, because that's not really allowed either, they'd walk by their cell later on and be like, "You good?" You know, just something very simple, "Need something," etc., and then continue on. And those are the incidents that really stood out to individuals. And there, it was actually that those meetings that suggested to me, where it was clearly stated that if I ever wanted to do work to really improve the prison context for those incarcerated, I needed to look at those working in the institutions. And that developed into a lot of discussion about, do I do it in the federal setting or the provincial setting? So they spoke more of the challenges of the provincial setting, especially remand institutions, and that's where my work went. And that over time has led to this need to look at the overall well-being of correctional staff, because it's very clear, and it's not just institutional correctional staff, it's people working in administration, it's people working in parole or probation, it's all correctional staff. It's a very difficult environment to be employed within. Mm-hmm. So that's how that happened.
And you have a number of people you're working with on this project, partners and so on. Can you tell us a little bit about the broader context in which this research is taking place?
Sure. So that started as kind of like my own little project with a grant from SHRC and going on. And then over time, as we're looking more at the trauma experience, because that was one of the things that became really clear. I would go into an institution to do interviews with correctional staff. And there were times where people, they experienced trauma, and a trauma that we can't quite imagine. In the correctional institution, a correctional officer is a paramedic, they do fire, they do police, like they enforce, they do all of these jobs. And many will talk about the times that they've cut down an individual who had tried to try death by suicide. They'll talk about all they've responded to riots. They've been in a lot of precarious situations. And they've had to do forced overtime. They have to. There's many things that people have to deal with that we don't normally deal with in a day to day on the outside, and they never get to leave that environment. So they're there and they're always working within that same environment where whatever had happened, it's right there. There's mm-hmm. no big change. There's no, and it's a constant sense of anything can possibly happen. So other than, unlike for police, for example, when you're walking to a car or going to a call, you're in a setup where you know now that there's uncertainty. The correctional work is constant uncertainty, and we know that uncertainty takes an extreme toll on our well-being and our stress levels. So when I was doing that, I started looking at the trauma that people experienced and how underreported it was. And it was later on when I was organizing with Safety Net and Dr. Stephen Bornstein, we started organizing a post-traumatic stress disorder conference. And within that process, I was introduced to a variety of researchers who were working together to create the Canadian Institute of Public Safety Research and Treatment. And at the time, corrections was not included. It was the three first responder groups. It was police, paramedics, and fire. And I ended up joining Nick Carlton from Regina and the other researchers as the lead of the corrections sector. And that sector is to be housed here at Memorial. So together we started working together, and the Canadian Institute of Public Safety Research and Treatment, it is comprised with a steering committee that includes representatives from each of our large public safety organizations, right from Public Safety Canada, like the ministry itself, to, you know, the Chiefs of Police Association, the RCMP, Correctional Service Canada, the Paramedic Association of Canada, the Fire Association of Canada. So we have, in the different unions, so we have vast representatives of a lot of people in decision-making positions within their organizations who genuinely care about the well-being of the persons employed within their groups, which I think is an exceptional and very value-added need. And then we also have the support of our Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodall, who has been very clear, like one of his mandates is to do something to respond to the health and well-being of public safety personnel. So we're working towards making that happen.
Yeah, one of the things your team did is you organized a major survey for the first time of first responders to see how many of them would report incidences of workplace trauma. So how did you set up that study?
So that was, you know, one of the challenges we had with at the beginning of the conceptualization of SIPCERT was that when the minister asks, or even the prime minister asks, well, how many people have post-traumatic stress disorder among public safety personnel, we didn't have an answer. Numbers can range anywhere from 7 to like 32-42%. There was no consistency, there was no clear comparison. So what we needed was a prevalence study. And Dr. Nick Carlton from Regina really took the lead on that. And with a lot of consultation, like the publications that come out have a lot of authors because it takes a lot of work. It's a vast and large project. But what we did is we created and put in all these different scales and put together a survey that people across disciplines, so from epidemiology, psychology, sociology, criminology, etc., all agreed that we were getting the information we wanted and conceptualizing in a way that was both valid and reliable. And then we had all the different public safety groups across Canada helped us, including we even had a little promotional bit from the Minister of Public Safety, encouraging people to participate in what was a very long survey. So we took, after that survey closed, and you know, there was the potential for, you know, it was administered at the time to at least 300,000 public safety personnel, or it was intended to. If it actually went out to all those groups, it's difficult to know. But we got a large enough sample back that we could get prevalence rates. And we've been working really hard with, like, there's a team of epidemiologists, there's the psychologists, there's a vast team that's all involved in the analysis of this data. And our first publication came out from that. So basically how it works, and CIPCERT is trying really hard to maintain the gold standard of research so that we respond to all the different needs that are necessary to have very reliable and valid information out there. So we took the initial analyses, they went into embargoed reports with Public Safety Canada that gave everyone a chance to kind of figure out how to respond while it was going through the peer review process. And only after the peer review process is complete do we put information out for general consumption. So that's been our standard and what we're maintaining and adhering to. So we have one paper out that was, you know, it kind of suggested of not the best picture in terms of the mental health and well-being of our public safety personnel across personnel. We have another paper that should be out in a couple of weeks that again talks more about suicidal ideation, lifetime suicidation, which paints another not very good picture. And we have a variety of qualitative papers coming out, and the papers on chronic health coming out, on traumatic incidents. So there's a lot of work in progress, but it's a really vast data set, and there's a lot of due diligence involved in the process. So we're taking our time with it, but we want to ensure that the information that comes out works. And it's the pre-study to the actual larger epidemiological StatsCan study that will be able to get these rates in more in places where we didn't have enough representation. So we can't speak, for example, of what these rates are like in Northern Labrador because we just didn't have the representation necessary in order. We had participation, but not at the rate we needed to be able to say things without compromising anonymity and confidentiality. So we're looking at a way with Stats Canada to actually get the rates we need. Mm-hmm.
So what about some of your findings? What is your group finding so far? Are there major differences in the way different groups of people experience trauma? Are there differences across occupation, race, gender, age, and so on? It'd be interesting to know what you're finding amid all this data.
So what we're finding by occupation, we know that, and of course at this point, without a clinical interview, we just know that people screen positively for the caseness. So they have the symptoms that are tied to the different mental health disorders. However, we cannot say without a clinical interview that a person has the disorder. And that's really, really important. And those are the little caveats that we're really trying to stress when we look back on it. Because in order to have an actual diagnosis, you need to have a clinical interview by a clinician. So not a family doctor, but by an actual clinician, which brings another point that we can talk about is the lack of treatment options. Mm-hmm. But we found, so for municipal and provincial police, rates of major depressive disorder were around 20%. General anxiety disorder is about 15, and PTSD is about 20. Around the our CMP, we found rates of PTSD at 30%, major depressive disorder around 32%, and anxiety disorder around 23%. And this continues. So correctional employees, I really stress within correctional employees, more than half of our correctional employee sample were administrative. So this is not correctional officers in the institutions. We're talking about people at headquarters, and this was only federal, not provincial corrections, where there's different nuanced challenges associated with each. So even with these caveats, our rates of PTSD were 30%, 32% for major depressive disorder, and general anxiety disorder, again, we were at almost 24%. So, you know, and if we continue on with them, firefighters, we had lower for PTSD, we're only 14%, yes, so not low at all. 21% for major depressive disorder and 12% for general anxiety. Paramedics, again, jump up pretty high, where we have PTSD at 25%, 30% for depression, and 21% for general anxiety. And another area that is included that most people don't think about is dispatch. Mm-hmm. Call center operators and dispatch, We had 18% for PTSD, major depressive disorder was our highest rate at almost 34%, and 18% for general anxiety. So in overall, we could see that any positive screen for any mental disorder, so across the board, in our total sample would be 44.5%. So with provincial police, we're at 37, RCMP, we're at 50, correctional workers were at 55, firefighters at 34, paramedics at 50, and call center dispatchers at 48.
Yeah.
So, and I'm looking at these, I don't know these off by heart, so I'm checking them as I speak of them.
Yeah, and it's shocking in a way and depressing in a way. I mean, I think Canadians are, if you read the Globe and Mail, you're very aware of the stories they've run, the personal stories about soldiers who've experienced combat and the problems that they've had with PTSD in many cases and problems with suicide in the military. I don't think the personal safety workers get as much press and that their stories get told. And I'd be interested to know if your team has tracked the impacts of these mental health challenges in people's daily life. How does it manifest itself? Is there stress in marriages, family life, job losses? Are people tragically taking their own lives? How do these challenges manifest themselves, in other words?
So when we look at that, so CPSRT, the Canadian Institute of Public Safety Research and Treatment, we work very closely with CIMVAR, which is the Canadian Institute of Military and Veteran Family Health out of Queens. We share the scaffolding and how our structure is. So we're all very, actually, when you look at people who do military work and you look at people who do public safety work, the researchers across these disciplines overlap a lot. So,
sure.
And the other thing is RCMP vets are also under Veteran Affairs Canada. They're considered vets just like military.
Mm-hmm.
So we do know, despite all our knowledge of what happens with PTSD among military, their rates are significantly lower than those among public safety personnel for post-traumatic stress and suicide ideation, etc. So we have a very strong problem. If you look back, look at our province right now, in the last not even 18 months, we have lost two RCMP officers and one dispatcher to death by suicide. In our province, which is not a large province.
It's not a large population, no, 500,000 plus people.
So if you look and you follow and you start watching the death by suicide that occurs among our public safety personnel, mm-hmm. it is quite difficult. But this is also serves as a vast motivation for all of us to make the work count and to move it forward. Of course, these things affect all aspects of a person. Like, there's a variety of different stigma that we still need to deal with. There's the idea of, you know, if something like coming forward and saying, yes, I have a mental health condition, or I need help, asking for the help. And also, even if you do come forward and ask for the help, there's those concerns about how that's going to impact your job long term.
Right.
So it's quite challenging on many levels. And of course, mental health, as we're all aware, impacts all aspects of our life.
You some of your material, your team has uncovered quotes from public safety workers where they say they seem to sort of dismiss the idea that mental health challenges and post-traumatic stress disorder are an issue at all. They say, if you can't handle it, you should have never gotten into this profession.
Does
or that it's the new quote unquote back injury that that people are trying to get time off work and so on. And so tell me a little bit about that experience of gathering those quotes and that information. Is there sort of a backlash within these organizations, or how effectively are they dealing with these issues? And or is it just individuals that have some of these kind of what we might call backlash sentiments?
I think it's a really complicated, I think it means a lot, and I really value that people will disclose whatever their views are, positive or negative, because that gives us the information we need to really understand how things are being viewed. But there's a variety of things, I think, that impact these more negative views as well. And they're not just as simple, I believe, as an individual feeling that it's, you know, kind of like abusing the system or playing the system or just a fad. Because what also happens, for example, you have different positions. So the RCMP, for example, if they have a unit in one of their detachments in a shift, and they have multiple people on maternity leave, for example, they don't backfill those positions.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you're leaving your shift understaffed. And then if you have people off on leave for other reasons, your shift is just, and the same work, you're still doing the same work with fewer and fewer individuals. So when we have these structural things, which then becomes a big discussion of the economics of policing and the lack of resources we have in terms of that, you have these structural issues that then make it really hard. You want your partner, because we see this, you want your partner, you want the people you're working with to get help for anything, because you also don't want to work with someone who could be compromised for something outside of their control. So people want them to get help. But at the same time, once the person's off for X period of time getting help, you start to feel the stresses of having so much extra work that you want them back. So it's a really, you know, there's a lot of difficulties, and these are very human responses. So it's never as simple. Like, if you feel that someone's taking excessive time off, you're going to start believing, even though, you know, 3 months prior you knew that they needed the help, that's going to change your views, because that's, we're human beings. So there's a lot of systemic issues that I think could really help with creating the needed resources. And also, you know, earlier intervention, prevention, etc. Like, we need to have these resources out there so that things don't escalate.
Yeah, and that's a good segue to talking about treatment, and are these people who are suffering from these mental health challenges, are they getting the treatment they need? Are there enough supports out there for people?
So one of the big things that we're doing right now as CIPCERT, and that we're looking to do locally in this province, if things, you know, continue to line up and we can do it, is to really create the necessary treatment. So one of the biggest problems we have is, even if we had $1 billion, we don't have the human resources to provide the needed treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, right off the bat, we have a massive problem. There just aren't the people that are necessary, that are trained as well, to provide the treatment for this population, or any population for the matter. We all know about the long wait lists. We all know all these different challenges. So we need to find ways around that. And that's what we're really working hard to do. And because this is my own home province, I'm really working hard with different groups right now, nationally, in order to see what we can set up here to start sort of like piloting and seeing if we can get better treatment options available, so that we can respond effectively and quickly to people's needs, so that these cumulative incidents don't have to build up, and people have people to talk to in a fashion that is more confidential. So one of the things, for example, if someone was to go on the CIPCERT website, one of the things we've made available now is a screening tool. So you can actually go on the website, you can pull up this tool, you can check what you want to screen for. It's totally anonymous and confidential. We actually do not track who uses it or the results. So we don't track any of it. That was one of the most important things. You can screen, you can do, like, let's say the anxiety screening. You can get your results. It will show you not just where you score in terms of the general population, but where you score in terms of other people in your profession. So you might be, you know, we all are kind of familiar with the R2MR, red, green, yellow, red.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be, you know, green for correctional work, but, you know, red for general population. So you're actually doing well for people in your occupation, but
right.
You're doing poorly in terms of the general population. You can get that score back. You can print it out and you can take it to someone and start your process in order to. So we're trying to do little things to provide assistance. So those screening tools are publicly available to everyone. We're working really hard right now to make our 2MR more affordable and available for everyone. So because our 2MR was created to be accessible, so we're trying to make it accessible for everyone. So we're trying to do things that are very pronounced and that can have a positive impact, and in a way that's affordable. Because we have volunteer firefighters up in Natwashish. They don't have the money to get people trained in R2MR, and or, you know, to go in to do these screenings, initial screenings or anything else. So we're trying to look at all these different needs and find solutions, but, you know, tried, tested, empirically supported. So we're moving slowly, but we're moving carefully, and we're really trying to make an impact.
So aside from, I guess, treatment, and you sort of hinted at this already, but I know in your work you referred to some supports that could be there in the workplace and in the home. So I kind of, things that would help, but they're not necessarily treatment options. What kind of supports could be there for these kind of workers at home and in their workplaces?
So that is an area where there's a lot of potential things, but we need more research. So for example, a lot of peer support type models, or many of these systems, these kind of things exist, but we don't have, even our 2MR, we don't have research showing the effectiveness of these programs. So as much as there's a lot of programs, and there's a blue paper that Nick Carlton was a part of and led that talks about all these different peer support and support programs that are out there, and the conclusion is really we need more research. We're not saying that they're not good, but we're not saying we can't support them fully because we don't know the outcomes. And that's really, really important. So I find a lot of the times when it comes to these types of things, there are a lot of potential things. I think wellness, there's lots of different wellness initiatives, there's lots of different SISMs, peer supports, home supports, etc., that could be incredible, but I don't feel that I can speak to them in a way that's empirically validated at this point. But okay. My hope is to really see more research on effectiveness, mm-hmm. so that we can start looking at these different programs and reshaping them, or being able to give more support to different programs' use. Because mm-hmm. a lot of them seem great, but...
Who knows at this point? Yeah, so there's a lot of unanswered questions at this point. We're sort of at the beginning stages of trying to recognize and deal with these problems.
This is no different than when I started my prison research, where every time I wanted to answer a question, I had to do like 3 other studies first.
Yeah.
It was the same thing. Like, you realize that there's all these gaps, and you need an interdisciplinary team to fill them in.
Yeah.
This is, I work alongside, on my specific corrections team, there's a psychologist, there's a clinician, there's an epidemiologist, there's people who are in the field. I work very closely with Correctional Service Canada, provincial corrections. Like, it's, and we need this interdisciplinary team. Mm-hmm. We need to mix, and the stats we're dealing with, it's, we need a team of epidemiologists to organize it.
Well, and again, that leads nicely into my next question, which is that your team has called for a national action plan. So you talked about some things that can mm-hmm. be done in the home and the workplace, but that there needs to be a kind of pan-national plan on the issues of mental health for public safety workers and personnel. And so what will be included in that plan? What kinds of things should government be looking at?
Our business plan, again, is going in very, very soon. We're all involved in those final stages of just ironing out the details. But it's how CPSR came about. It started with the Prime Minister, who requested from the Minister of Public Safety Canada that we need to do something about public safety, treatment, and well-being. And CPSR has been growing and developing for the last 4 years. This is our 5th year. I haven't been involved since the very beginning. So as that continues, the parliamentary report that came out a year ago now, just about, gave a bunch of recommendations on what this national plan and institute should look like. They considered that we call it not CIPCERT, they called it CIPSOR, and we decided that we preferred CIPCERT as a name.
Okay, so what would CIPSOR stand for?
It was the Canadian Institute of Public Safety Research Officers or something like that.
Okay.
We didn't necessarily like how it sounded.
Mm-hmm.
So we preferred the T. And they gave us a lot of recommendations on how it can be structured, what it should look like, and what we needed to do. So when we had Summit, which we actually had here at Memorial, so Memorial has a very strong role in CIPSR with the University of Regina, and we also are connected to Queen's, Wilfrid Laurier, and the Justice Institute. When we had Summit, we really went through with all the Public Safety Steering Committee, so all these leads and these organizations, plus the core academic researchers, and we've also brought in people in the local community. We had multiple ADMs there, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
But we really went through these parliamentary report recommendations and how we were responding to them and creating the nuances of that business plan to create a national strategy that's going to cover both research and treatment. We have right now in development these first like national longitudinal, 10-year studies where we track people from recruitment, like candidates, through their career to see what's happening. And these trackings are not, there's the sociological component of it, but there's also sensor tracking and the physiological and the psychological. Like, it's a comprehensive interdisciplinary study. And when the results are out, it'll be the future generations of researchers who get to play with this amazing data
mm-hmm.
and make the impact. But we're setting it up. We want to have short-term actionable things we can do, but we really want to create the data and put ourselves in a position to help fuel knowledge of the future.
Yeah, and in that spirit, I would just maybe close off by asking what comes next for your research team. What questions are you looking at? What do you still need to answer on this issue?
Oh, goodness, there's a lot of stuff on the go right now. We have, across populations, if I speak to corrections specific, we're looking at putting together a similar 10-year longitudinal type study. Right now, because provincial corrections did not participate in the prevalence study, I'm in the process of getting every single province to participate in a correction-specific prevalence study so we can know more about those rates with the team. So then there's the long-term with the more qualitative component through CSC. We are also looking at doing some actual, like, changing. We're trying a couple of things to see if it can happen in terms of changing how people have access to psychological services while waiting for insurance to come through. So kind of seeing what we can do in terms of workers' compensation and insurance coverage so there isn't as much a delay, which is really complicated because even if we can find a way that people can get reimbursed immediately for services they seek, if I was to say to a clinician, you know, I'm in serious trouble right now, massive suicidal ideation, like I have real issues, they still have a 6-month wait list. So it's like, you know, we're trying to do a lot of things, but then we have a human resource problem. But we're really looking at that. So our objective is short term, things we can do quickly and have an effect on the person. So treatment related, quick, longer term in terms of real research implications that can tell us a lot about prevention and what happens on the field. And then middle ground projects that can lend us a lot of insight into specific needs and what's actually going on. So we're trying to cover all of those at all times. Mm-hmm. And we're always trying to respond to the needs put forth by the Public Safety Steering Committee.
Yeah, I think what's interesting and I guess hopeful about your research is that you're linking to a real need in society. And I think in some ways the research offers a lot of hope to public safety personnel who are suffering from mental health challenges and issues. I think you're making a real contribution.
I would say from the team that I work with, from Nick Carlton, Heidi Cram is at Queens and she's the head of fire. A Memorial alum, actually. Mm-hmm. Renee McPhee does paramedics, and she's at Laurier. Greg Anderson, who is out at the Justice Institute in BC, who does police, and then myself. And even the other persons around, like Diane Grohl, that we all work with, the team at U Manitoba, everyone genuinely cares. It's like working in a family in many ways, where we are very motivated by what is happening. And we see a need, and we all work closely with the populations that we work with. So we've all experienced, and we've all experienced a lot of loss. Mm-hmm. So we've also become supports for each other, and we just don't want that to keep happening. It's silly. There's no need. Like, these are people who serve us, that we call every time we're in trouble, but then we're not responding as a society to their troubles. It actually makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So that has to change. And we take that position very, very strongly and rather publicly. And then we see it. We have a minister. Our Minister of Public Safety is right there. He's the biggest supporter of this. He wants this institute.
Well, that's fantastic. And I want to thank you for coming in this morning and talking to us about your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
For more information on Rose Ricciardelli's work, check out the links on our show notes or search for her web profile at Memorial University's Department of Sociology. To find out about future episodes of Cross Currents, you can follow us on Twitter at Nexus Center, search up the Nexus Center Facebook page, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. This episode of Cross Currents was edited by MUSEP student Kyle Johnson. The music used in the podcast was licensed under a Creative Commons license, and you can find out more about the music through links on our show notes. The Nexus Center is generously supported by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences and the Vice President's Research Office at Memorial University. For episode 4 of Cross Currents, we will begin a series of podcasts drawn from a workshop at the Nexus Center on how to better insert environmental humanities research in the public realm. We hope you can join us.